President Bu Nygren issued a statement expressing his support for former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, nominated to lead the Department of the Interior. A California tribe is celebrating after the Biden administration greenlit its petition to put land into trust for a casino north of San Francisco. Jacob Resnick reports.
The Koi Nation of Northern California applauded the U.S. Department of the Interior's decision on Monday to put 68 acres into trust for the Shiloh Resort and Casino in northern Sonoma County. The decision follows a federal judge rebuffing attempts by a neighboring tribe to block the development. Darian Beltran, chair of the Koi Nation Tribal Council, said the federal government's approval fills the tribe's hearts with promise and hope. But neighboring tribes, including the Federated Indians of Greaton Rancheria, which operates a casino complex 15 miles south of the site, has called the project a travesty as it's outside the Koi Nation's ancestral lands in a neighboring county. California Governor Gavin Newsom also had urged the Biden administration to reject the casino project that includes more than 100 table games, 2,700 slots, and a 400-room hotel. The Koi have signed an agreement with the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma to manage the casino and resort. I'm Jacob Resnick.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 16th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dave Johnson, Althea Billings, Isabel Charlet, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Israel and Hamas agree on a ceasefire deal. A fight within the Trump circle over immigration. And Biden issues a major order blocking offshore oil drilling. First, Israel and Hamas reach a ceasefire deal. If the deal is actually culminated, it would have four major components. The first is that Hamas would release 33 living hostages over a 42-day ceasefire period in exchange for the release of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. That first release of Israelis would include children, women, and injured people. In the second stage, all remaining hostages and prisoners would be released. A third component of the agreement is that Israel would agree to allow hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians who have fled the bombardment in the south of Gaza to return to their homes in the north. And the fourth part is that, according to an Israeli official, Israel will maintain a buffer zone in Gaza. Among the crucial details that have yet to be revealed are, first of all, how many Palestinian prisoners would be released from Israeli jails, and how many Israeli troops would be deployed into the buffer zone in Gaza. While the deal is welcome, we need a reality check. This deal could have been concluded last May. For 8 full months, writes Alon Pincus in Haaretz, such a deal was presented time and time again by Qatar and the United States. But Netanyahu only had politics and his own survival in mind, and then the U.S. election and Trump's inauguration. A fight within the Trump circle over immigration. While the Trump crowd is united in favor of mass deportation of illegal migrants, they are divided over approving H-1B visas for technically talented immigrants. Elon Musk used that e-visa after entering the U.S., and his companies have hired hundreds of skilled workers under it. Numerous people who have gone on to be investors and engineers in high tech came to the U.S. under H-1B visas. The reason I'm in America, along with so many critical people who built SpaceX, Tesla, and hundreds of other companies that made America strong, is because of H-1B, Musk said. I will go to war on this issue, the likes of which you cannot possibly comprehend. In fact, as the Washington Post reports, quote, as Silicon Valley companies compete to create artificial intelligence products, the need for foreign-born talent has intensified. 28 of the top 43 AI companies in the U.S. were co-founded by immigrants, and 70% of full-time graduate students in AI-related fields are international students, according to a 2023 analysis from the National Foundation for American Policy. Dependent on Silicon Valley money, Trump has come down on Musk's side, upsetting the far-right's anti-immigrant crowd. Steve Bannon, for instance, called Musk a racist because he's a white South African and a truly evil guy, pledging to, quote, take this guy down and kick him out of the MAGA movement. Musk's sole objective is to become a trillionaire, Bannon says, and he's a proponent of techno-feudalism on a global scale. That last comment may be Bannon's real beef. Trump, on the other hand, said inaccurately that he has always supported the H-1B program. Fact is, in 2016, Trump called for the H-1B visas to end. His companies have long relied on H-2B visas, which offer unskilled workers. Trump's appointment of Sriram Krishnan, a technology entrepreneur and investor who was born in India, as his senior policy advisor on artificial intelligence, sparked anger among many of Trump's supporters. They shared the usual racist tropes about foreign-born people who are taking Americans' jobs, an argument once used by Trump. By contrast, Musk and his Department of Governmental Efficiency colleague, Vivek Ramaswamy, are campaigning for continuation of the visa program. Musk calls the MAGA critics of H-1B contemptible fools. Ramaswamy says normalcy doesn't cut it in a hyper-competitive global market for technical talent, and if we pretend like it does, we'll have our such-and-such handed to us by China. Interesting that limiting immigration, a hardcore right-wing issue, has come back to haunt the MAGAites. And here's something else that may haunt the true believers. The Department of Governmental Efficiency, the Orwellian plaything of Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, plans to have representatives stationed inside federal agencies. This is akin to the Chinese Communist Party's stationing of party secretaries inside every school, factory, and government agency. It's not just an efficiency system, it's a spy system. With the power to recommend termination of programs on grounds of efficiency, these Dogeites, loyal to Musk and Ramaswamy, will inspire anger and chaos. The dysfunction they would create will, I think, prove legendary. Next, President Biden issues a major order blocking oil drilling. In his last days in office, President Biden issued two memorandums that prohibit future federal oil and gas leasing across large swaths of the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific, the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and the northern Bering Sea in Alaska, 625 million acres of ocean. Industry groups and the Trump transition team attacked the news. A Trump spokesman said, "This is a disgraceful decision designed to exact political revenge on the American people who gave President Trump a mandate to increase drilling and lower gas prices. Rest assured, Joe Biden will fail and we will drill, baby, drill." Biden acted under the 1953 Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, which allows a president to withdraw federal waters from leasing. Congress would have to act to undo that decision, and one representative in the House has said his party will seek to squash Biden's decision using the Congressional Review Act that requires only a majority vote. In other news, Myanmar, the former Burma, has become a criminal state. While a civil war rages in Myanmar, the country is now the biggest nexus of organized crime on the planet, according to the Global Organized Crime Index. The New York Times reports, quote, "It is now the world's largest producer of opium and one of the world's largest manufacturers of synthetic drugs, including methamphetamines, ketamine, and fentanyl. Concocted with precursor chemicals from neighboring China and India, tablets made in Myanmar feed habits as far away as Australia. With factories in overdrive and international law enforcement overwhelmed, street prices of these drugs are alarmingly cheap," unquote. But that's not all. The country's northern borderlands are largely the domain of Chinese criminal syndicates. Production in Myanmar intensified after a crackdown on the assembly of drugs in China. The chemical precursors instead found their way to Myanmar, and Chinese lab technicians taught locals how to craft crystal methamphetamine, also known as ice, in jungle redoubts. Chinese kingpins brought in pill presses to make yaba. The Times reports that the syndicates, quote, "are operating with impunity and monopolistic ambition in the region, despite occasional crackdowns by Beijing. Chinese weapons flow both to the ruling junta and to the resistance forces that are fighting it. In Myanmar's borderlands, criminal networks that unite Chinese kingpins with ethnic warlords are kidnapping people from all over the globe to toil in factories that scam people online. The longer the civil war in Myanmar goes on, the more involved in illegal activities are the military junta, ethnic armies, farmers, and even the pro-democracy forces. That's because of international sanctions and an economy riven by war, forcing everyone to find alternative ways to make money." China and the U.S. exchange charges of cyber hacking. Christopher Wray, the outgoing FBI director, said that hacking operations from China were now directed against the U.S. at a scale greater than we'd seen before, larger than that of every major nation combined. Those are quotes. In fact, if you took every single one of the FBI's cyber agents and intelligence analysts and focused them exclusively on the China threat, China's hackers would still outnumber FBI cyber personnel by at least 50-1, he said. How he knows the number of Chinese hackers is beyond me. What we do not know is the actual value of all the Chinese hacking, which has mainly been economic espionage. 9 U.S. telecommunications companies were hit with a cyber attack, believed to have been originated in China in 2024. But more recent attacks have been against U.S. government agencies. As 2025 began, Chinese cyber espionage was declared responsible for security breaches in the U.S. Treasury Department's office in charge of international sanctions, many of which are directed at Chinese entities. We also don't know about the hacking operations the U.S. and other governments are engaged in against China, but it's fair to assume that they are doing it. The Chinese have reported hacking incidents on occasion. For example, in 2024, a National Computer Emergency Response Center in China claimed that in 2 incidents, U.S. cyber attacks had led to theft of, quote, "a large amount of trade secrets." The targets were said to be an advanced materials design and research unit and a large-scale high-tech company focused on intelligent energy and digital information. China's trade surplus sets a record. China's customs agency reported that the country's trade surplus reached nearly $1 trillion last year. The General Administration of Customs said that the country exported $3.58 trillion worth of goods and services last year, while importing $2.59 trillion, a total foreign trade of more than $6 trillion. The resulting surplus of $990 billion broke China's previous record, which was $838 billion in 2022. Virtually everywhere you look, Europe, Russia, Southeast Asia, India, China's exports far exceed its imports. That's good news for Chinese exporters and for employees of manufacturing firms, but not necessarily good news for Chinese consumers. Import barriers mean high prices and consequent recourse to saving rather than spending money. The flooding of the world market with Chinese goods that consistently underprice all other countries' goods also is resulting in trade protectionism, with rising tariffs not just in the U.S. and Europe, but also in Brazil, India, and other mid-range developing countries. Honduras responds to Trump's mass deportation plan. The president of Honduras, Xiomara Castro, said that if the U.S. carries through on its plan and deports Honduran citizens, Her country, which hosts the largest U.S. military task force in Central America, will close down its base, which houses about 1,000 military and civilian personnel. Without paying a cent for decades, she said, they maintain military bases in our territory, which in this case would lose all reason to exist in Honduras, unquote. Closing down the base would probably result in a considerable loss for Honduras, not just of U.S. aid, but also remittances by Honduran immigrants that may account for as much as a quarter of the economy. As the Times reports, more than 500,000 undocumented Hondurans, about 5% of the Honduran population, were estimated to be living in the United States in 2022. Honduras, Mexico, and a few other Latin American countries are preparing for the deportation while also stressing the importance of their immigrants to the U.S. economy. Claudia Sheinbaum, Mexico's president, has said, quote, we will continue to demonstrate how the Mexican people in the U.S. contribute in a very important way to the U.S. economy. And if Mexican people were not in the United States, there would be no food on American tables. Latin American foreign ministers will be meeting soon to discuss Trump's plan. President Biden nixes the takeover of U.S. Steel. The president decided not to allow Nippon Steel of Japan to take over U.S. Steel in a deal valued at $14 billion. The decision follows on months of deliberation that eventuated in the conclusion that a takeover would not be in the national interest. U.S. Steel workers were against the deal, as was a federal panel that reviewed it, on grounds that Nippon could not offer assurances for union workers or about the company's future in Nippon's plans. Litigation will follow, as leaders of both U.S. Steel and Nippon Steel want the deal to go through. But in the meantime, Biden's decision, which Trump says he would also have made, will upset relations with Japan and may impact foreign investment in the U.S. generally. Another genocide. The U.S. State Department has charged that the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces in Sudan are guilty of genocide. That group says the department has, quote, systematically murdered men and boys, even infants on an ethnic basis, and deliberately targeted women and girls from certain ethnic groups for rape and other forms of brutal sexual violence. Sudan is experiencing famine, a refugee crisis, and a high death toll believed to be around 150,000 so far. So now we have genocides in four countries, Israel, Myanmar, China, and Sudan. So much for never again. Finally, one update. North Korea's deployment of more than 10,000 soldiers to the Ukraine front is proving costly, according to U.S. and South Korean sources. They say around 10% of those soldiers have been killed in action. Originally, it had been thought that these were crack troops, but predictions that they would have a tough go of it in unfamiliar territory and language problems have proven correct. Two wounded North Korean soldiers have been captured. Kiev also says around 3,000 North Korean soldiers have been killed and that some have committed suicide. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to get the latest in our Oregon arts news. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea. I always love to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. Lots to discuss today. Getting into some of the recent things published by Oregon Arts Watch as we get into 2025. Something that sort of bridges the last month or so is a series that you've published called Freedom to Read, Library Book Bans in Oregon. There's three quite comprehensive articles by Amanda Waldrop. Talk to me about this series. Where did the idea for this kind of project germinate from?
Yeah, Amanda covers libraries for us, and it was a passion that she had. She did this three-part series in particular about challenges to books. She did a really good job about providing the whole national context for this, in addition to what's happening in Oregon specifically. So the idea is that book challenges are at an all-time high. The numbers really started shooting up in 2020. There are a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is because book publishers are producing more books by marginalized communities, racial and ethnic groups, and people who identify as LGBTQ+. And it's part of the culture wars, you know, culture wars, especially surrounding gay and transgender rights, racial justice, women's rights. A lot of this has really taken hold, well, since 2020. It was happening before that, but it has really skyrocketed. It's been, a lot of these challenges have been somewhat of an organized effort by extremist conservative groups. They have lists that they have made and circulated. And so people glom onto those lists and they challenge the libraries. And so it's been there's a whole interesting process around that. A lot of these challenges are considered a threat to intellectual freedom, the right to read and be exposed to ideas and the freedom to think and form own opinions and express those opinions, freedom of speech. So librarians now are actually better prepared to deal with a lot of these challenges. They've strengthened and clarified their policies, and they want to engage in conversation with people and educate them. They are trained in library science, which is the idea of, you know, how we consume information, and so they want to have a give and take about ideas, and so a lot of what has happened with a lot of these challenges is that library supporters have actually stepped up. Communities have organized to defend books and libraries. They've organized to send out text messages so people show up to meetings when books are challenged.
A lot of what I got from these stories was both how, you know, Oregon isn't unique in having to deal with this, and in fact, it's much more intensified in many other states, these efforts to ban books. But to underline it, who is it that wants books banned? Who is going to, you know, school libraries or the local library trying to get books banned, and what is their rationale?
Yeah, a lot of it is conservative people who object to the content of some of these books. The American Library Association reported that in 2023, 4,240 books were challenged, which was a 92% increase compared to the previous year and was the highest number ever recorded. So that was for public libraries, and then in school libraries, the challenges were even higher. PEN America reported that 10,046 challenges were submitted for the 2023-2024 school year. And in Oregon, that was nationally, and then in Oregon for the fiscal year 2023-24, which ended through June of last year, there were 63 challenges, which was the second highest ever recorded. There's also been an uptick in just libraries and librarians facing harassment. So they've had to sort of prepare for this, which wasn't something that they really had to do before. They've had to examine their policies and guidelines, strengthen them, rewrite them, make sure that they're very clearly in place, and they've stepped up efforts to explain what those are. And libraries have a really rigorous standard based on library science and free speech law to put those guidelines, policies, and protocols in place that they follow. So it's not like they just order a book. The books actually have to have a certain merit that's very well defined before that they will purchase it and put into the library. Yeah, and they have, when it comes to these challenges, the librarians will often explain existing law and the Constitution and what's known as the Miller test, which has established three criteria in order for books to be labeled obscene. There are certain standards that they have to measure. So once, you know, all those things are explained, it makes it it helps to inform the public about how they operate.
I also wanted to mention one of the specific anecdotes that is discussed in the Freedom to Read series, which is what happened in Seaside, Oregon, where a city councilor sort of tried to sneak in a book ban or request a book ban through other people, and it ultimately ended with him being recalled by the community.
Yeah, that was an interesting case. The councilor wanted to change the policies for public libraries and actually sent notes to a couple of supporters who in turn challenged books. So it was an organized effort to challenge these books. It wasn't one person who actually, you know, really objected to it, but it was an organized effort by this one counselor. And then the counselor faced a recall. The community galvanized and they went to meetings, and then they actually recalled this counselor by a whopping 63%. So what this has done to galvanize different communities has been interesting. Yeah, and it's kind of important to define what a book challenge goes through. So there are different vocabulary that's used. A challenge is a request to move a book. A ban will completely remove the book, and then a restriction will limit access. So who can check out the book, or it's put in a protected area or a certain area that it can only be viewed there. So there are different ways that books can be listed. And then a challenge requires a formal like application that's submitted, and then it's reviewed by a whole board. It can take a whole year for the whole process to play out. And then again, there are a lot of considerations to think about and determine. There's also just an uptick about how librarians have faced more vitriol. In fact, there was a study done by graduate students at the University of Washington where they analyzed the language that was used in the applications that were challenging books. And they actually, you know, categorized all the different language and the different language that was used. And so they noticed a whole uptick in the really strong language, more vitriol, that was used. And clearly, you know, there was one thing that's been noted is that it does seem to target marginalized communities quite a bit. And so there are considerations of, you know, does this constitute discrimination? So all of that is interesting to take into account.
Another thing I found interesting in these pieces was the data supporting that banned books actually get a lot of increased interest from that community that people then want to seek out and see for themselves if the material is objectionable. I wanted to ask you, you know, we're having a change in the presidential administration. Did the author of this story expect that we would see change on the national level? I mean, Project 2025 doesn't explicitly ban books, but it's in that world.
These stories actually do discuss that. It discusses how Project 2025, apparently there was a lot of pushback about banning books, so they altered the language, but there is definitely a concerted effort to develop policies to do more book challenges. So it's not they kind of came back from or stepped back from saying that they were outrightly going to ban books, but they are hoping to increase their efforts to develop policies to work to ban books. So all of that is discussed. I thought these stories did a really good job of explaining the whole national context and what was going on, as well as particular incidents happening around the state. There's also, Amanda has documented in other stories that there have been challenges to funding for public libraries and what's happening there. So there's a whole effort to challenge libraries, which is, you know, a part of our thinking and free speech rights.
Yeah, there's something along those lines happening in Josephine County right now.
Yeah, exactly.
There's another story from Oregon Arts Watch I want us to be sure to touch on, which is called Turning the Page, Looking Back on 24 and Ahead to 25 by Bob Hicks. Can you give us some of the big takeaways from this story as we enter the new year?
Yeah, Bob does a terrific job of taking all of our coverage from 2024 and putting it into context, and he highlights major stories, but he also kind of rounds them up so that you kind of have an understanding of the bigger picture that these are a part of. And then he looks ahead to 2025 and what a lot of these developing stories mean. He does a really good job. So the story's titled Turning the Page, Looking Back on 24 and Ahead to 25. And the top of the story in particular talks about a roundup of big development efforts and moves and building that's happening in the arts and culture world. I mean, we often think that the arts have been it's been hard for them to recover. There are a lot of real reasons why that has happened and why they have experienced hardship, no doubt. But there are a lot of really hopeful stories. So the Portland Art Museum has been working for many years to redevelop. They're building a new structure. They're going to better integrate the two buildings. They used to have sort of a basement warren of way of galleries that were sometimes difficult to find and then get back from. So that will all be better integrated, and that's set to open later in 2025. It's been a $111 million project, so that's exciting, but that's been happening. And there's a whole, like, recovery of downtown Portland, the Central Library.